today. Manchester by the Sea and La La Land are in the top 10.
Yeah, that's good for La La Land. I was trying to engage one of the commenters on HE, who had made a big thing about he expects it to be a popular film, but only with the cultured review reading, you know, urbanites who are, you know, follow film columns and are, you know, big movie buffs. But the mainstream is going to shine it, he believed. This is Bobby Peru, that guy Bobby Peru, because he thinks that basically people don't want to know from musicals and it's an outmoded. So what has happened, do you think? Why do you think it's doing as well? Obviously, I don't think he's right in his projection. Why do you think it's working?
Well, first of all, when we saw it, you saw it at Telluride, I saw it at Toronto. I mean, there was no doubt that the critics were going to be on the bandwagon with this film and that it was going to be a crowd pleaser. But the big question was, can this movie make money? And it seems like it can. But I find that a lot of these films now, like Manchester, like La La Land, these days, reviews actually matter. And I'm starting to realize that they matter more than ever now, because I didn't even expect Manchester by the Sea to already be making to have already amassed $15 million by this point of the year. I just think as there are plenty of sequels, plenty of prequels, reboots, just flooding the box office, this is incredible counter-programming for adult audiences, and they're just coming out in masses to watch these films. And La La Land, Manchester are two of the best-reviewed films of the year. And we're seeing an incredible audience response towards those two films.
So you're basically just saying quality wills out. People can smell something that's good, and when it comes, give it to them, and they'll show up. That's it. Pretty simple.
Yeah, especially in 2016, where I think you are seeing a lot of adult audiences complaining about the lack of quality in movie theaters these days. And I think Oscar season is great counter programming for mature, intelligent adult audiences that want a great movie.
What do you think is going on, however, with I think that that Emma Stone's performance, and this is full respect to Natalie Portman, I'm not in any way diminishing, but I just feel that Emma Stone reaches inward and finds elements of such intense disappointment and sadness and the struggle that she goes through, to not so much in the romantic end, although that's also a struggle, but also in terms of her just trying to find some kind of creative fulfillment and make it to some extent in the industry, and it's just one slap after another. She gets, you know, told no, no, no. So it's a real, it's not a, La La Land is not a, really not about escapism. It's not about ha-ha, you know, have a good time, you know, singing and dancing. It's really a kind of a tough road that they both go through. So I was thinking Emma Stone really does reach down and deliver. To me, I mean, she is the Jennifer Lawrence in Silver Linings Playbook performance of the year, no question. And yet, she's just not making it so far with any of the lead-up groups. I mean, apart from SAG, yes, she got nominated by SAG, but she's not won a damn thing. And usually, if you're going to, you know, be the likely winner, or if you're going to look like the likely winner, you win one or two Critics Award. You know, you're part of the good, small group of people that are winning, and she's not winning anything. So when is she going to start winning something? I'm kind of concerned or flummoxed about that.
Just think that the critics fell head over heels for
Isabelle Huppert.
And I think she's just the critical favorite. But I'm really not worried about Emma Stone's chances. I think she's still the front runner, and she's
Okay, I'd like to think that also, but what are you basing it upon? She's not winning. What's going on? Just because you feel personally feel she's the best, so do I. But what tells you that she's got the momentum or the support or in the industry? What tells you that?
Well, she's well liked in the industry, and I don't really think Isabelle Huppert has a chance to win the best actress. I mean, she won't possibly get nominated.
No, I agree with you about Huppert. I mean, there's always that xenophobic thing that always kicks in. I agree with you.
Yeah, she's gonna be the number five probably.
Yeah.
But and I really want her to get nominated. I mean, it's a great performance.
Yeah.
It's masterful.
Yeah.
But I think also Emma, as I just mentioned, she's Stone is well liked, and that performance is great. I mean, to me, it's the movie.
Mm-hmm.
No disrespect to Ryan Gosling, who is great in the film, but if there's no Emma Stone in that film, it's just not as good. And she just has charisma, and she just carries the film, and she's the heart and soul of La La Land.
Yeah.
And
Here's hoping for her. I don't know. You know, I just want to know, when is the other shoe going to drop and something happens in her favor?
Well,
I mean, you know.
She's probably going to win the Golden Globe.
Yeah, so what I'm not so much talking about Isabelle Huppert, and I know she's going to win it for, actress in a comedy or musical format, no question, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, what I'm wondering about is that there seems to be this gathering, building sense that Natalie Portman has put it down, and people are responding as much to her and maybe even more to her, and that's what I'm wondering about. Not so much Huppert, but as Natalie Portman. So.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you've spoken to people that didn't respond to Jackie. I know I have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love the film, but it's divisive.
Right.
And the fact that Portman already won also kind of just makes the award just more stones.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if Portman hadn't won for Black Swan, I think we'd be probably saying that Portman might pull off the win, but I don't know. I mean, I still think that Sandra Bullock didn't win any awards, really.
That's a good point. She just, you're right. She just came in at the end and just took it. You're right. That's true. That's true.
Yeah. And she just took it. She was well loved in the industry, and people said she was due.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't really put too much emphasis on. On a Stone not winning much. I mean, you know, we both loved La La Land, and we both know that it's probably winning Best Picture.
Yeah.
I don't really see anything right now. It's the clear-cut frontrunner. Is there anything that can beat La La Land?
If I were voting, I would vote for Manchester. I happen to feel it's a more solidly rooted film. But no, I understand and completely. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. Manchester is a slightly better film, but La La Land's a great movie, and it's an homage to the classic Hollywood musicals. But it's also, as you mentioned, it has such sadness in its frames, and it reminded me a lot more of the Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Sure, exactly.
Than any of the classic MGM musicals, to tell you the truth. I think that's what makes it such a beautiful work of art. It doesn't necessarily have a happy ending.
I'm going to talk about the two big spoilers that have come out this week. The first one was, of course, the Peter Cushing thing in Rogue One. And the phrase that I am, it's going to make me sound like I'm not that hip, but the phrase that I'm not familiar with, and maybe you can tell me the origin of it, is Uncanny Valley, which is a term that alludes to some kind of CG manipulation that just doesn't work. Is that what you, where did you first heard that term, Uncanny Valley?
I've not really heard that term before.
Okay, well then that's two of us. A lot of people in the comment thread on the Peter Christian thing were using the term Uncanny Valley. So I've been searching around for it, and I haven't seen the origin, but it was used enough. So anyway, the long and the short of it is, I thought that was by far. I know it's not completely there, and if you really study it, and they used a lot of darkness and shadow in Peter. Have you seen Rogue One?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
So I thought it was about my assessment of it was really good, best thing I've ever seen of that type, bringing back a dead person, and it was maybe 80% there, huh?
Yeah, but it still felt cold and distant. Like you knew it was CGI, but I agree. It is so far the best use of that technology, but. I don't know. I mean, it's a risk what they did using it for Christian and using it for Princess Leia as well.
Well, that was we're not. Nobody's actually said that. So we've just blown a thing here. But basically, that's what I probably one of the things I really liked about Rogue One. I didn't really think it was that great of a film. It was kind of made my. I felt like I had bees buzzing around my head as I was watching it, but it was. But the way it fed right into the very beginning of Star Wars in 1976 was brilliant, I thought. And I just said, this is a very satisfying way to end. Even if she didn't look right. The reason she didn't look right, her CG thing, is that she, you know, there's too much light on her face and it's well lit, whereas Cushing is is more in shadowy in the darkness of the Empire of the Death Star, and you can't see him as well. But it's go ahead.
There's actually a Norwegian actress that came out on Twitter yesterday saying, okay, now that Rogue One is out, I can finally say that I played Leia at the end. So I was really trying to figure out what she meant by that.
Who said that?
I'll get the name for you.
An actress?
A Norwegian actress.
Okay.
I'll get the name for you.
Right.
But I have it here. But I guess they used her body and some of her facial structure because does look a bit like Carrie Fisher.
Right.
What her name is.
I think I would have preferred, because you can tell right away it doesn't quite look right, and I would have preferred if they had somehow harvested Carrie Fisher's images from the first Star Wars and somehow worked from that rather than a new actress. I mean, probably somebody would say, well, that doesn't look right or something, and I don't know enough about the technical end, but I just knew this, hey, nice try, but it doesn't work.
So her name is Ingvild Deila.
Okay.
And she tweeted, as a Star Wars fan, I'm incredibly thrilled, grateful, and honored to play Leia and be part of this beloved and amazing universe. So I presume that they used her facial structure and they used her body for that.
Are you looking at a photo of her?
Yeah. It's a...
Would you mind sending me the link to this so I can find her photo? I can do a little thing about this.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sure. I was surprised. I thought that it was all it was all effects, but it wasn't. But yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about the last 15, 20 minutes. That's the clear highlight of the film.
Sure. Yeah.
Because you're wondering, okay, how are they going to tie it in with A New Hope? And they do it brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
But, the rest of the movie was not that effective, really. I was, my patience was wandering, and I didn't really think it was that good of a movie. And it's funny, because right after the Hollywood premiere on Sunday, people were just raving about it on Twitter, which just goes to show you should never really trust first tweets.
Yeah, particularly with the Star Wars films, people are very emotionally inclined to want to embrace it. They want to re-experience that surge they felt when they were younger, and the older Star Wars films. I feel an attachment to it because of the great highs I got off of Empire Strikes Back, and to some extent the first one, but the other ones have all been underwhelming or disappointing or flat-out dislikable. Hated the prequels, hated Jake Lloyd, hated Hayden Christensen, the whole thing. I really couldn't stand it. But
Were terrible.
Yeah.
They were terrible prequels. But also, I think that's what made me like the J.J. Abrams one from last year, The Force Awakens. It was the nostalgia factor. It just really fed with that nostalgia that we have for the original series.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it did work, and it definitely suckered us into writing good write-ups for the Force Awakens. But I mean, a year later, when you look back on it, you're like, oh, it's not that good of a movie. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it follows the same path as A New Hope, the same narrative structure. It's.
Mm-hmm.
No, am I looking forward to the next film? Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I am. I mean, they can definitely do something good with the next film. But I mean, I think there's an over exaggeration with seeing it before everyone else, which is what happened at the Hollywood premiere for Rogue One. Everyone was like, "I'm first. I saw it." And I mean, if you read those tweets, everyone was saying it's the best thing since A New Hope, and it really clearly isn't.
Why would anybody say that? I mean, I thought there was an absolutely universal understanding that the high watermark for this whole franchise is Empire Strikes Back. Why would anybody say it's the best thing since, you know? I mean, there's no question that Empire Strikes Back is a superior, darker, richer, more fascinating film, particularly because, as you know, Empire Strikes Back is the only one that seems to be really a midpoint film. It doesn't really have an establishing, a beginning of a story. It just sort of starts in the middle of something, and it ends in the middle of something. Nothing is resolved, and it's all darkness, and it's all getting chased and getting your ass kicked. It's really a beautiful film.
It's very grim.
Yeah.
And it's the only one not directed by George Lucas.
Yeah.
which really makes a difference. I'm not sure if he wrote the screenplay. I completely forgot.
No, he was involved in a lot of it. He did work with Leigh Brackett on Empire Strikes Back, and then apparently he didn't like what her input was, but out of respect to her, and she had been around for so many decades and worked with Howard Hawks and everything, but he decided to give her a screen credit. And Larry Kasdan worked on that film also, but apparently not as much as people would like to think. So I'm not trying to just diminish Lucas's input. I'm sure that I know that he was not as interested in making The Empire Strikes Back look as good as it does. If you look at every scene in that film, the lighting is way above the level of Star Wars and Return of the Jedi and anything. I mean, there's very careful shadow lighting. The compositions are magnificent. And that boils down to one thing. They took more time to do the setups. They weren't in a hurry. And Lucas got, according to what I've read and what Kurt Legend, he was very upset at the overruns. Gary Kurtz, the producer, was blamed for, quote unquote, losing control. Well, basically what that boiled down to is that they were making it look better than the original. And it really is a wonderful looking film in so many respects. I mean, just not just the finale, but everything. It really is gangbusters in terms of composition.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Even the snow scenes are beautiful.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I'm looking at the IMDb for Empire Strikes Back, and mm-hmm. George Lucas only has story credit. He doesn't have a screenplay credit. It's Brackett and Kasdan who.
I think he was trying to do Leigh Brackett a favor, though. I don't think according to what I read, he didn't, regardless of what the credit was, he did not care for what she had given him, but out of deference and respect for her, he gave her the screenplay credit.
Well, it ended up being the best Star Wars movie we're likely going to get.
It's a
great movie.
This is what I hope. This is what's so great about it. I would hope that the next one, the one that we're going to see at the end of 2017. That was that is going to be a more of a serial like thing that does is kind of a middle film, you know, in the middle of something, not ending it, and hopefully if they adhere to that type of thing, which of course the middle prequel did not, maybe it'll be something. Who knows? I mean, remember that J.J. Abrams said that the script that of number 8. Is better than what he did with number 7, and he wishes he could have directed it.
So. Well, it must be because the number 7 was really they were just going by the same blueprint as A New Hope, just trying to build up characters, trying to there's a beginning, middle. It's basically the same beginning, middle, and end structure of A New Hope, But Rian Johnson, who's directing this one, is a director that I followed since his very beginnings, and he's one hell of a talent. He directed Looper.
You're a fan of that film?
I like Looper. Yeah. I like Looper. Visually, it was great, and even story wise, I found it was very solid.
Okay.
But Rian Johnson has a big. Following online, and a lot of people were not happy that he went the Star Wars route because they wanted to know what his follow-up to Looper would be. But I think he's going to make something very special with this film.
Yeah, I hope so. I like the guy personally, and I think it. By the way, I had dinner with Mr. Johnson in Paris about 3 years ago. And he was had just attended a Wagner opera at the in the Place Bastille, and we met for Indian food. And he's been reading me and following me. We kind of know each other somewhat. And you're bringing me up short here because I'm wondering, have I been mispronouncing his first name? I always thought, even though it's spelled R-I-A-N, that you pronounce it Ryan anyway, and you're giving it a Rian sound. Have you heard that from somebody, or have you been told that's how you pronounce it?
I've been told anything. I've just been saying Rian for the last few years. Maybe it's Ryan.
Maybe. Or maybe it's Rian. I don't know. I know he just. I know that he never corrected me, but maybe it is. Maybe it is.
Well, it makes sense that it could be Ryan, though.
Okay.
I'll have to get to the bottom of this. But
incidentally, speaking of Sundance for a second, I just wanted to zip over to something. There's a thing that somebody told me that I was looking at part of my list of 2017 films that are worth. Worth watching and worth catching, or at least the ones that sound good. This guy said, why haven't you mentioned Kyra, or Where is Kyra, the one that's going to be at Sundance that is directed by a guy I don't know, Andrew Dosenmu, and it was and co-stars Michelle Pfeiffer and Kiefer Sutherland, and I don't know anything about Bradford Young, good DP, is or at least a respected DP, not my favorite, but it's it's supposed to be. You heard anything about it, or you read anything? I haven't actually.
I haven't heard much about it, and even the director, Dosunmu.
Dosunmu,
he's born in Nigeria.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean Michelle Pfeiffer and Kiefer Sutherland and Bradford Young as a cinematographer. You must at least keep an eye on that. But
originally called then. The original title was Beat Up Little Seagull. I don't know.
Is that going to be in the premiere section?
Yes, it will be. I don't know that. It just says it will premiere at the festival. It doesn't say it literally will be in the premiere section. But maybe.
I've actually not done too much research yet on the Sundance selections. I mean, I know some of the well-known directors that are having premieres there. But I usually do a bit of research to see. because it can be a bit overwhelming to go there, because a lot of these filmmakers are not well known, a lot of them, it's their first film.
My basic thing at Sundance all along is that I've always found that I tend to spend most of my time at the Eccles with the premieres, because I know that the heavier hitters tend to show up there. That means you'll be lucky and run into a Manchester by the Sea or something like that. But my flaw in my approach is that I don't spend enough time at the library, which is where the dramatic competition films show, and that's where you're really special. Where did that come from? Nobody. Who is this guy? That kind of thing can happen at the library, whereas the Eccles, is going to be, you're going to have some high-impact films, at least two or three, you always do. But, you have to pay attention to the dramatic competition, and that but you go there and just kind of, you kind of wing it. It's like jazz, you throw the balls in the air and you decide on the moment, where to go. So.
It's fun to do that. I mean, compared to if you go to Telluride or Toronto, the filmmaker, so it's not as big of a surprise. It's like discovering Memento in 2001 at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody expected. But at the same time, I think we kind of lucked out last year with Manchester by the Sea. My expectations aren't that high for Sundance. I don't think we're gonna get something as great as that film.
Mm-hmm.
And also the dramatic competition. There's a lot of duds in there usually.
Mm-hmm. The most vivid memories besides Manchester was the big premiere of Nate Parker's film, which the entire community was so impassioned about that film that if you said not that good or not bad but not good, take it easy on it, don't get so enthusiastic, I was actually accused of being a closet racist. I have some sort of agenda against Nate Parker. What's my problem? What did I get with the program? Everybody loves this guy. This film is what we need in Hollywood. It's we got to get behind guys like Nate and not do the Oscars so white thing, everything. And it was just astonishing how that whole thing collapsed 8 months later. I mean, it was quite the drama.
I had people arguing with me when I told them that I didn't like the film at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it was that big of a deal at Sundance last year, and to think now, people, I mean, even the critics were very cold on it when it came out. I mean, I remember you getting a lot of heat for mentioning that it just wasn't that good.
Yeah, it was pretty bad, and it wasn't that they disagree with my view. It's like they said, "What are you really trying to say? You got a problem with Nate Parker? Is it you got a problem with African American filmmakers? What's your deal, man? You got to get with the program here."
Yeah, and I remember someone comparing it to a Stanley Kramer film.
Yeah.
Dead on.
Yeah.
It's funny how at Sundance you can just build up this buzz for a film, and then once it comes out, it dies. It happens at Sundance.
Yeah.
No, I remember just off the top of my head, Tadpole, which was this Sigourney Weaver film with I forgot the name of the actor, but this kid falls in love with her, and she's like in her 50s, and that sold for $8 million, I think. And people said it was going to be the next big film, and then it just completely bombed. I mean, do you even remember Tadpole?
I did. I was one of those people who was really behind it. I really was pretty turned on by it. I don't remember how many years ago that was, but it was...
Well, it must be 2002, 2003.
Around there, yeah, okay. And I honestly was one of those people who was saying, gee, this is, you know, boy, it sure it rang my bell. I had a good time with it. I was kind of surprised. Yeah. But that mountain air syndrome, which is what it's called, you know, you're kind of breathing less oxygen, and so you like certain films in a really ecstatic way, and you get very excited. And then what happens? It gets down to Los Angeles and plays in New Jersey and places like that, and it's just like, huh? You know, it just doesn't. It's funny. You know, it's like a movie sometimes is only as good as the audience that gets the humor and laughs with it and claps for it. You know, it really does make a film seem like something else. You know, it adds a quality of exceptionalism that if you don't have a good crowd seeing it at the Plex, at the Megaplex in Paramus, New Jersey, it's just not going to feel like the same thing.
Yeah, it's the air. It's in the air, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think, because Tadpole is not the only example that I can give. It seems to happen on a regular basis at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have a film like Manchester by the Sea or Memento that still matters when it comes out months later. So I mean, you know, Sundance is a fun time, but sometimes people just go head over heels for a film that just ends up being nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw it this year with Birth of a Nation, but I wonder if that whole controversy hadn't happened, if Birth of a Nation would actually be a player at this year's Oscars.
I remember I came up with that phrase last year, that term, when I had heard about the Greasy Strangler, and guys like Jordan Hoffman and others were, you know, I called them boner buddies. You know, I describe them as nerdy film festival elites who get off championing icky cult films that will probably have trouble attracting average Joes in the commercial arena. Well, I didn't see Greasy Strangler until after, but that's exactly the kind of thing that some of those guys, they just go crazy for, and they really get off on it, and they're kind of out trying to outdo each other in the blurb department when they write the reviews, and they just go nuts for it, and you see these things. What are you talking about, man? But that's the way Sundance is. That's the mentality.
Yeah, and it's going to happen again this year for sure. I mean, I don't doubt it at all.
Yeah,
it's just part of the Sundance tradition. But it's all in good fun, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing I love about Sundance is that you can go into a film completely cold, not knowing anything about it, and it can end up being a great film, and that's the best feeling. That's why we love movies so much.
Yeah.
the element of surprise, not knowing anything. So
what was that movie that was shot in, that was kind of a Tarantino-esque thing that was shot in Englewood? Dope. Do you remember Dope?
Yeah, sure.
That was a huge Sundance thing. People were just really literally bounding out of the theater doing cartwheels and handstands and talking about how it really was the second coming and let's get behind this. I thought it was a reasonably okay film. You know, I didn't, but Rick Fumiyawa was the big hero. Everybody loved it. And I, you know, that really didn't translate for me. I mean, I didn't understand why they were that turned on about it. I thought it was, you know, had its moments. And, you know, pretty good film.
Yeah. That same year, me, Earl, and the Dying Girl won. And I was at that Sundance as well. Mm-hmm. And the reception for that film was incredible. It won the Grand Jury Prize. I believe it won also the Audience Award. And when it came out, I mean, the reviews were good, but it really didn't change the spectrum whatsoever. But just reading the reviews for that film at Sundance, you'd expect it to be a huge critical favorite, but it ended up being met with a shrug. I don't even think it made that much money at the box office.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
I respected the filmmaker. It was like he was like a Wes Anderson-like filmmaker. He really knew his Criterion films. He had the right mentality. I related to him. I met him at a party later that year and introduced him to Jane Fonda, and she liked his film, and they had he's a cool guy, but I just we're just basically saying over and over that there are Sundance hits up in the mountains, and then there is what connects with people when you come out of the mountains. So it's always a different thing. So what about the Passengers? What about the Passengers thing? What about your ethical feelings about how that film grapples with the idea of a guy who basically is so lonely that he decides basically to destroy a woman's life by giving her a life that's only about essentially confinement on a huge luxurious spaceship. And doesn't give her, basically say your life is over except for this spaceship and hanging out with me. And some people in a poll that was conducted by the Telegraph in England, at least when I saw it, 41% agreed with me, which is that it was horrific for a guy to do that to somebody. Mm-hmm. And yet about two-thirds of the respondents were more or less okay with it, and they understood it, and they didn't have a problem. I was astonishing the ethical perspective of people. Where do you come down on all this?
It's a selfish act, and they still fall in love.
Yeah, but no, they fall in love before she finds out. Remember.
Yeah, exactly.
And he doesn't tell her right up from the go. The bartender spills the beans, and it's done a little better in the script, but he doesn't tell her. I mean, there's a trailer thing that says, where he says to her, there's something I haven't told you. He never has that moment. He gets busted by the bartender.
Yeah, they must have cut that scene out or something.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Ethically, what he does is disgusting. Mm-hmm. And that whole film. I mean, you kind of knew that it just wasn't good just from the moment that trailer dropped. And
what told you it wasn't good? What was the indication? Because it looked handsome. It looked well produced, and it looks like something that might be diverting for a couple of hours. What told you it wasn't good?
I don't know. There was just something, the aesthetic or the, and also it just wasn't getting any buzz as the months went along after the trailer hit.
Yeah,
it just kept. You weren't really hearing mm-hmm. You weren't hearing people say, oh, what about Passengers? Does that have a shot? I mean, it just really, and now it's getting released mm-hmm. this coming Friday, I don't really think it was ever in the conversation for some reason, because I mean, at the beginning, before the trailer hit, you had people saying, oh, Passengers, that could be an Oscar, mm-hmm. that could be a contender. But after that trailer hit, I don't know, just something happened. And also, I had heard of test screenings that just didn't go well as well.
Yeah.
And and it all just came down crashing.
What do you think about the, as you may have read in the, when I first, I decided to discuss the Peter Cushing thing. After there were three websites that Cinema Blend was one of them. There were two others that were kind of fanboy sites. Plus Variety went with the whole thing talking about Peter Cushing element. And I was saying, I would have figured that the time to raise this would be at least after the first weekend. Let people see it, discover it on their own, then talk about it on Monday. And people would still bitch, say, hey, I haven't had a chance to see it. And the response is, well, this is the world we live in. You gotta get there the first weekend, or you can't expect people to sit on big news like this. But then, I got yelled at anyway because I didn't blow the secret. I held on to it, but I felt as long as other people were letting it out, when it's out, it's out. What do you feel about these spoilers and people running with these things early? I mean, obviously, the Telegraph writer, Rebecca Hawkes, and Bob Strauss, they have these pieces out discussing the moral, ethical quandary in Passengers. What do you think about the whole thing of when is the right time to go with these things?
I don't know. I think we just live in a world now where it's very hard to keep these things secret. And And also, I mean, I saw Rogue One on Monday, and it came out 4 days later, and I had no idea about Peter Cushing whatsoever or about Carrie Fisher, but I mean, you know, again, we live in now with the internet. If you just keep reading about a movie, you're going to end up shooting yourself on the foot and getting something spoiled. It's just how it is now.
Yeah, people have to. If they really don't want spoilers, they should really stay away from the conversations, particularly after the press screenings.
Yeah, and even like for example, I'll give you an example with Scorsese Silence. I really tried to refrain from reading anything before I actually saw it. I knew about the book. I knew what it was about, but like I just wanted to go in with an open mind and not knowing too much about it. And I think that's the best way to go into a movie. I know there's a lot of people that read up a lot about a movie before they actually go and see it. And I think that they just end up shooting themselves in the foot because they'll end up finding out.
Yeah.
For example, about Peter Cushing or about The Passengers, spoiler alert. You just have to be cautious. You know, it's now in the internet age, anything can be spoiled.